all that, didn't I? Getting ready, getting sorted out. I'm actually preaching from one of my birthday presents. New tablet. Yeah. So, given the past few weeks, sort of ignoring today, how have you been taking the heat? Thank you. Somebody agrees with me. How many people have you heard, oh, it's too hot? Can't wait for it to stop. Why don't it rain? Yeah. How many? Exactly, Tony, yeah. How many people have been saying that, oh, the gardens need it? Well, give it to the gardens. I don't want it, you know. For once, we've had something like a summer, yeah? It might have come to an end, although it did still, yeah, it could start again, yeah? How many people remember last year when it was sort of reasonably good during June, throughout the 6 weeks holiday it rained, and people saying, oh, we'll have an Indian summer, we'll have an Indian summer. Well, unless the Indian summers are sort of wet and drizzly, then I guess we didn't really manage that, did we? Yeah, monsoon. Do you know, it almost gives truth to the Australian saying, how do you know when a plane full of Brits have arrived? The engines stop and the whining still goes on. What's it been like in the kitchen when you've been cooking? Oh. Get the windows open, let the flies in, you know, things like this. How many people have got aircon in the cars? Yes. Do you know, as this heat wave was beginning, they got the radio on at work. It was quite a nice day. It wasn't as hot as we'd had it here. It was about sort of May time. And the presenter said on the radio, he says, do you know, he says, first warm day, he says, this is when you discover when your aircon isn't working in the car. And would you believe it? I went home that night, pressed the button, and my aircon did not work on the car. But it does work now, and I'm very glad about that. It does make a difference, doesn't it? How many people have thought about having aircon installed at home? How many people can afford to have aircon installed at home? We're not very good at taking the heat, are we? We're not used to it. But there are other ways of taking the heat. I mean, you might have come across the phrase, taking the heat. It's talking about opposition or pressure or blame or punishment. People say, oh, you know, I'm taking the heat for this decision that I made. I'm taking the heat for what I've done. And the fact of the matter is that as Christians, we get to take heat. As Julie said, you know, sometimes one solution can be two different people. Be Christians here and don't be Christians elsewhere, and you don't get any heat. Hopefully, none of us think that becoming a Christian means plain sailing, no problems, no issues, everything's hunky-dory. We even sing that it isn't, yeah? But it can be very hard when we're going through the process of taking the heat for standing up for what we want. The problem is, as well, that we might find that it's not a case of going through it, it's a case of enduring it, because there isn't going to be an end to it. As I turned 50 and I was starting to get aches and pains, it suddenly occurred to me, what had occurred to a lot of people beforehand, is that some of the things that go wrong with you are not going to get better. You know, as youngsters, you're used to getting something, I don't know, even breaking a limb or whatever, and you're going to go through it, aren't you? And you're going to get better and you're going to go on. But there are times when that does not happen. Mm. It's not a case of going through, it's a case of being in. And, you know, we can have the heat of suffering, because we suffer just like anybody. But I'd like to ask you, is there anybody who still expects that bad things only happen to bad people? Is there anybody who still thinks that if you're good, nothing wrong will go in your little bit of life? Everything will be hunky-dory, straightforward, no problems, no issues. You might hear the phrase, I never thought it would happen to me. Well, exactly, Dave, why not? If I always do the right thing, I'll be okay. No? No, exactly. How many people, though, when suffering, think, what have I done wrong? What have I done to cause this? And in many ways, we need a theology of suffering. You know, in John 9, 1 to 5, the disciples came to Jesus, thought they'd bring him a nice, meaty, theological question, because, you know, this is a rabbi that you're talking to here. Seen a man, he's blind. Say to him, now then, who sinned, his parents or him? You know, give us the answer to that one. And Jesus said, it's neither. That's not the case at all. Before we go on with that, have you ever heard the phrase, there is no such thing as a stupid question? Yeah? You sometimes find it in presentations. People are trying to make you comfortable. They want a feedback. So to relax you a little bit, they said, there's no such thing as a stupid question. I want to tell you something. There is. There are such things as stupid questions. This is apparently true. All right? Whether tail end's been changed or not, I don't know. But apparently there was a trial going on in America. And the lawyer said to the pathologist, was the victim dead when you performed the autopsy? To which the pathologist said, yes. He says, could you be sure? He says, well, his brain was in a jar on my desk, so yes. If he wasn't dead before the pathology, he was certainly dead afterwards. All right? That's a stupid question. The tail end is that the lawyer said, are you really sure he was dead? At which point the pathologist said, no, he was rumoured to be practising law in this town. Think about it. This question that the disciples have brought to Jesus is something of an equivalence to that. It's not stupid because it's impossible. God can obviously see what's going to happen and act accordingly, you know. If he decided that because of this parents, the parents of this man had been bad, then he was going to punish his son, then that's possible for him to do, yeah? It's even possible for him to see what the man was going to do and punish him before he actually did it. Yeah? That's quite within God's power. But it's stupid because God does not act like that. And he actually tells us that. You know, Job is one of the earliest books in the Bible. If you have a look through those pages, very few people do read the book of Job because they find it boring. There's some very interesting things in there, but one of the things it points out is Job had done nothing wrong to merit the things that came his way. Yeah? The summation of the book of Job, is that God did things his way because he wanted to. And all the questions that Job gave were not answered. God just gave him another load of questions to think about. A cancer sufferer, Kate Bowler, said this, having cancer didn't make me question God, but it did make me question what Christians told me about my suffering. She's a professor of theology, and when she got the cancer, she wrote a blog about it. And she says, you know, the two main responses that she got on the blog. The first was that you've done something wrong. You've sinned. So you're suffering. And the other one is that you don't have enough faith, so you've not been healed. Those were the two main things that she got. But the fact of the matter is that we don't always get answers as to why something is happening. As I said, Job didn't get answers, he got questions. And if you look through the Psalms, you'll see many questions there as we've been looking through the Psalms. We've looked at many of them, talking about the questions that the psalmist brings to God. Psalm 6:3, my soul is in deep anguish. How long, Lord? How long? When's it going to stop? Psalm 13:1-2. Says this, how long, Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I wrestle with my thoughts and day after day have sorrow in my heart? How long will my enemy triumph over me? How long? Psalm 35:17, how long, Lord, will you look on? Rescue me from the ravagers, my precious life from these lions. Psalm 74:10-11, how long will the enemy mock you, Lord? Have you ever felt like that? Think, when's this going to end? When's it going to stop? Can I have an answer? You know, whenever you're going somewhere, it always seems to take longer walking to it than coming back from it. Yeah? Because you don't know where you're going. It can seem like ages and ages, but suddenly the journey back's been compressed and you get there very quicker. Obviously, you know your way. You know what to expect and what's coming. And just having the idea of when this is going to end would make it much better. But God doesn't work with us like that. You get a lot of whys in the psalm. Psalm 10:1. Why, Lord, do you stand far off? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? Psalm 22, the words of Jesus. My God, why have you forsaken me? Further on in Psalm 22, it says in verses 7 onwards, all who see me mock me. They hurl insults, shaking their heads. He trusts in the Lord, they say. Let the Lord rescue him. Even mocking the faith. Can we really believe that God can still do something great through our suffering? Because he says he can. The problem is we might not always see it, and it might not be what we want either. But in Isaiah 25 verse 1 it says, Lord, you are my God, I will exalt you and praise your name, for in perfect faithfulness you have done wonderful things. God is actually perfect in faithfulness. Mm-hmm. And he is faithful to us. And all he asks in response is to trust him. So he might not tell us when it's going to end. He might not say what the result of it will be. Mm-hmm. We might not ever see the result. I think we've mentioned before that Julie's mum prayed for Julie's dad day after day after day after day for many years. She never saw him come to the Lord. After she had died, he came to the Lord. God was faithful. Her mum never saw that. And we might not see the answers to our prayers. We might not see the results of what's happening. But God, the one we trust, will bring things about. And he helps us to take the heat that is associated with suffering. In the Psalms that we looked at, we covered a little bit of the fact of persecution, you know, mocking of the faith of the psalmist. And there is heat of persecution. You know, in the Western world, we've been through a time when it's been relatively easy to be a Christian. The majority of people thought it was a good idea, the morals and the teachings of the Christian code. Generally, society held broadly to the same values and ideas. And it wasn't considered odd to refer to the Bible. These days, if somebody says so-and-so, you know, from the Bible, think, oh, he quoted the Bible. Oh, yeah? Stories, themes, ideas were known and understood. You can talk to people these days and they've absolutely no idea what you're talking about because they've never read it. They might not have believed, but they understood the general principles and could see where things were going. It's not always been like that. Some people think that they're sort of reliant on Greek and Roman culture, you know, the ideas of philosophy and science and such like. A historian called Tom Holland, whose speciality is the sort of time period around about the New Testament, has said that he has had his thinking transformed. He's not a Christian, is at best agnostic, possibly even atheistic. But what he said was he always thought that he was the result of the Roman and the Greek cultures. You know, he was a scientist, social scientist perhaps, but he was a scientist and he followed the scientific method. And he was dependent on them for being what he was. But he says, as he studied them, he's been both fascinated and appalled by the might and the cruelty that was taken for granted and even exalted in these cultures. And he thought, actually, I'm not like that. The idea of mercy was not really found in those cultures. The idea of love and laying down your life for others because of love wasn't really found in those cultures. The idea of you just kill whoever and do whatever to get wherever you want to be was fine. You could even boast about it because it was the done thing. And he realized that that was not where he was coming from, but rather he was dependent on a Christian culture, which shocked him. So then he's looking at, where's this Christian culture come from? But you know, things have changed and things are changing. And in many ways, our society as it stands at the moment is post-Christian. In 1940, George Orwell said this: "For 200 years, we have sowed and sowed at the branch that we've been sitting on. And in the end, much more suddenly than anyone had foreseen, our efforts were rewarded and down we came. But unfortunately, there'd been a little mistake. The thing at the bottom was not a bed of roses after all. It was a cesspool of barbed wire." We cut our links to the Christian culture, thinking that we're not really dependent on it, and then we find out what we get as a result. It has been said that in numbers killed alone, the 20th century stands as the most barbaric, whether through wars, world wars, purges, both fascist and communist, the millions of people that have died. Well, who can calculate them? We're supposedly becoming better, more scientific. Well, actually, we're just getting better at killing people. And this knowledge and everything else that we've gained hasn't really made society that much better, has it? Society seems to be disintegrating rather than growing, evolving and developing. The years of godless philosophy have had an effect. You know, Christianity and the Bible are not considered as important. The stories are not taught because they're only fairy stories after all, is the opinion. The ideas of humanism and scientism rule rife. And I say scientism as opposed to science because scientism exalts science and says it's got all the answers. I don't read it, but I was told that GQ magazine ran an article. That article was 21 books you do not have to read. One of them was the Bible. This is what it said about the Bible. It is repetitive, self-contradictory, sententious, another way of putting that is it tries to appear wise, intelligent, and important. It is foolish, and even at times, ill-intentioned. So why bother reading it? That's a common opinion. The idea that we've outgrown all this imaginary stuff. It's considered out of date. There's no truth in it. And at best, it's considered as your truth, which doesn't fit me because I've got my truth. Jesus is considered an imaginary figure, that he never even existed. So if you're saying you've got some sort of relationship or connection with this imaginary figure, the thought about you is that perhaps you're not all there. But it's gone beyond that. The USA and Britain have laws that actually directly contradict what's taught in the Bible. People are taken to court for preaching in the street. People are taken to court for standing up for their beliefs. If you state your beliefs, you can be accused of hate speech. And it could get worse. Whether it will or not, I don't know. There's an awful lot of kickback at the moment where people are saying, hang on a minute, you're actually stopping free speech here. How that will develop, I don't know. We'll have to see and pray. But Jesus said in Matthew 24, verse 9, "Then you will be handed over and persecuted and put to death, and you will be hated by all nations because of me. You will take heat for standing up for me," is how he could have said it. But let's be honest, the sort of stuff that we get here in America just does not compare to other countries. Open Doors has a list of countries that it is fatal to be a Christian. Places like North Korea, Afghanistan, Somalia, Sudan, Pakistan, Eritrea, Libya, Iraq, and Yemen. You know, in North Korea, it was the standard thing that use an anti-aircraft gun to execute you. You know, that started up sort of will shoot whoever stands up and declares that they're a Christian or against the government. But then it was decided that a pistol wasn't good enough, so we'll use a machine gun. And then the latest one who's ruling there, he's decided he'll go one better and he'll use an anti-aircraft gun. Well, there you go.
Next one will be strapping them to missiles.
Yeah, quite possibly. But when you're dead, you know, well, there you go. But how are we to react? What are we going to do? Is attack the best form of defence? Apparently not. When Jesus was arrested in the garden, what did Peter do? John was talking about it this morning. Took a sword out, cut off the servant's ear. Jesus told him off. But what was the other thing that he did? He put the ear back on. He healed him. Well, he was an enemy. This guy had actually come to arrest Jesus. Why do you want to do anything good for him? Because Jesus was doing exactly what he's told us to do. He said, love your enemies. Do good to those who persecute you. And that's hard. But Jesus wants us to react as he does in the face of persecution. When we take the heat of persecution, we love those who oppress us. We love those who persecute us. Jesus said, rejoice when men persecute you and do all manner of things against you. Well, Paul and Silas did. You know, they were arrested. Okay, we could be arrested. But it says there they were stripped and they were beaten with rods, it tells in Acts 16. Then goes on to say, just to emphasize what had happened here, they were severely flogged. Now, you have to take into account the way people say things. You know, Julie says that she was upset when we were first dating because she said, you know, how did you like this meal that I've cooked for you, you know, that I've slaved over? And I said the words that sort of really set it above any other meal. And I said, oh, it was quite nice. Yeah, exactly. Quite nice. But for me, quite means good. Okay? That's the sort of set things in context. When that says in the Bible, they were severely flogged, I don't think we've ever seen anything like the sort of flogging that they had in those days. They knew they'd been flogged. They would probably have been dragged away, unable to walk. And what did they do? Did they cook up some plan, you know, to sort of get back at people? No, it says they sang and were praising God. Because Jesus said, when men persecute you and do all manner of things against you, what you got to do? Rejoice. Why? Because God is still in control. And that's exactly what they were doing. In Acts 5, 40 to 41, Peter and John have been there, walked in through the beautiful gate, seen a man, couldn't walk. They've said, get up and walk. He does. And then they've got hold before the Sanhedrin for it. And Gamaliel's speech persuaded them not to kill them, but to let them go. Except they didn't quite just let them go. It says they called the apostles in and had them flogged. Which means 39 beats, not 40, because obviously they couldn't do 40, so they only did it 39 times. Only did it 39 times, yeah. And it says then that the apostles left the Sanhedrin rejoicing because they'd been counted worthy to suffer. Suffering for his name, taking heat for his name. Love those who will persecute you. Do good for those who would say wrong against you. You might never see the results of that. He doesn't say, love those who persecute you and you'll see them saved. He doesn't say, do good to those who are persecuting you, and you'll find out, and you'll see how God wonderfully works in their lives. It doesn't say that. He asks us to take the heat of persecution, and he tells us how to cope with it, and that's the right way. The last one I want to look at tonight maybe could be used to roll everything up. John touched on it this morning as he was preaching. I was thinking, hang on, don't say too much, because that's what I'm talking about tonight. But God has brought it so they're nicely meshed together. Mm. You know, sometimes you will be called to take the heat of disappointment. The heat of disappointment. We suffer because we expected something different. We've not got what we really thought we would get. And we have got something that we didn't expect. Wendy Mann said this: hidden disappointment is slowly killing the church. Hidden disappointment is slowly killing the church. Paul Mallard has said disappointment leads to disillusionment, disenchantment, and disencouragement. Whether it's from suffering, whether it's from illness, you prayed and nothing's changed. Paul's been there. The situation hasn't changed. The hopes have been dashed. Sometimes a ministry has been halted. There's been illness. There's been misunderstanding, which caused things to halt and change. Maybe you've been sacked because of the system. Somebody who I know not very well was in a position of ministry, and they had this committee meeting, and what was supposed to happen was that they were going to take a vote of confidence in him because there'd been certain issues. And what the idea was that people would say, yes, yeah, yeah, okay to continue. But not enough people did. And so he lost his post. And when people were talking afterwards, they say, well, we didn't actually want him sacked. We just weren't quite happy with the way he'd done it. But we wanted him to continue in his job. But that isn't what happened. Was he discouraged? You bet. He went from suddenly a place of ministry where he's being paid very well. He was just working in a petrol station as an attendant. And it took him a long time before he was able to re-engage in his ministry. That certainly wasn't what he was expecting. And it was incredibly discouraging. God didn't act how I thought God ought to have acted. Life hasn't worked out how he thought it was going to be. You know, we sing God has plans for our lives. They don't always mesh with the plans that we've got with our lives. There can be worries of life, money problems. We can feel let down. But it all sums up with the fact that we can be disappointed in God. The first thing we need to do is not hide it, but to be honest. If we're disappointed and say, God, you've let me down, look in the Psalms. The psalmist can be very blunt with God and saying, what are you playing at? There's a need for honesty. But you know, disappointment can sort out our wrong beliefs about God. And it can help us to trust, because God doesn't let us down, even if he acts differently to that which we would have expected. Disappointment can either drive us from or to God. Thomas Edison, who invented the light bulb, is famously recorded as saying, I have not failed. I have found 10,000 ways of not making a light bulb. But he didn't stop. And he did make the light bulb. A guy at work was working with a professor in metallurgy. And what they were trying to do was make kitchen sinks. You might think, what? But the way they were trying to do it was out of a single sheet of steel, pressing the steel sinks in one go. Now, we take that as granted these days. You can just go to B&Q, wherever, and buy a sink. But it was a time when that could not be made in one operation. And Alan was working with this professor, looking at different ways of doing it, different combinations of chemicals in the steel, different ways of operating the press. And Alan had been working with him for a matter of months. And the professor had been doing this before that. And he says, why don't we stop? Because we failed. He says, no, we haven't failed. We've found lots of ways of not doing it. But they did find the way to do it. And now, it's just straightforward. They could have stopped, like Edison, at exactly one before they actually made it and got nowhere. They could have taken the heat of disappointment and melted and crumbled under it. Or they could have taken the heat of disappointment and say, well, we'll work this through. It needs a relentlessness. It needs determination. Sometimes it's hanging on by your fingernails. In Genesis 32, 24 to 26, Jacob is coming out to meet his brother. He's getting really worried, so he sends lots of people out in front of him so his brother meets them first and doesn't get quite so upset when he sees Jacob, because Jacob thinks, he's going to kill me. In the end, Jacob's on his own. He sent everybody else out in front to meet his brother first. It's come to the night and it says this: Jacob was left alone and a man wrestled with him till daybreak. When the man saw that he could not overpower him, he touched the socket of Jacob's hip so that his hip was wrenched as he wrestled with the man. And then the man said, let me go, for it's daybreak. But Jacob replied, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Because it turns out that the man who was wrestling him was Jesus before he came in the flesh. He wouldn't let go. He would not let go. He was almost at the end of his tether, the end of his strength, but he would not let go. He took the heat. The time has come, perhaps, to stop trying to work it out and to hold on for all we're worth. We can take the heat of disappointment. There are times when we will need to take the heat from various sources. And at times it will seem relentless and unnecessary. But as James reminds us in his book, in the first chapter, consider it pure joy when you face trials of many kinds, because you know the testing of your faith produces perseverance. Let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. And that might just be this side of eternity, but it might not. God intends any heat that we take to be for our good and for our ultimate good. With our hand in His, let's take the heat. Because you see, the heat refines, and God is in the refining business with each and every one of us. Amen.